Welcome to the Maritime History Program. I'm your host, Brandon Huebner, and this week we move on to Episode 3, Sargon to Hammurabi, Trade and Turmoil in Ancient Mesopotamia. Our first two episodes have looked at trade and boating in ancient Mesopotamia, and to briefly summarize what we covered last time, we basically witnessed the expansion of Sumer from a scattered farming society into the world's first true civilization. Society became less egalitarian with the emergence of a ruling class, and surplus grain, combined with the ambitions of the rulers, added up to spur on long-distance trade that reached south into the Persian Gulf and beyond. Now, in today's episode, we are going to cover a larger span of time than we have covered in a single episode up to this point. So buckle in as we look at some details about a certain Sumerian moon god and how his mythical journey can give us a little insight into the boat-building materials of pre-Akkadian Sumer. Then, we'll see how Sargon forged one of the first true empires, and we'll look at some records from Akkad that give us insight into the range and scope of Akkadian trade. We will get an overview of the gradual changes in trade that occurred in Mesopotamia, and we'll wrap up at a point that's essentially the end of ancient Mesopotamia's connection to maritime history, a point that's also near in time to the appearance of the Hittites, the end of the Bronze Age in Mesopotamia, and a sharp decline in Persian Gulf trade. Okay, let's start by looking at a few religious texts from ancient Sumer that can shed some light on the materials used to build Maugre boats, and just how important these boats were. A small caveat, though, first here. It is thought that the sacred boats differed from the everyday boats that were used by the common person. Remember last time we said that Maugre was the word used to describe the sacred boats of the ancient Sumerians. The Maugre boats that we're talking about here may have only been a small portion of the boats that were used in all of Mesopotamia as a whole, or they may have simply even been idealized depictions of boats that were beautiful enough for the gods themselves to have used. Either way, as with most things from this far back in history, it's a little difficult to pin down a concrete answer. Our first text today involves the Sumerian moon god, Nanna-Suwen, and his journey to Nippur. The text falls into a category of Sumerian literature that we call divine journey literature or stories. These were poems that describe a fictional journey that was made by a deity. These poems were treated as part of the Sumerian religion, and it's likely that they had some basis in religious rituals that were performed as a devotion to the gods. This first particular divine journey poem describes the moon god Nanna-Suwen as he constructs a Maugre boat and prepares it for his journey to deliver offerings to his father Enlil, who was the chief deity of ancient Sumer. Another little warning here first. Nanna-Suwen was also called Ashimbabar, so the two names within this poem I'm about to read are referencing the same character. Here are the most relevant portions of the poem, as they've been translated. It goes, Suwen sat about constructing a Maugre boat. He set about building a boat and sent for reed matting. Nanna-Suwen dispatched people to Tumal for the Maugre boat's reeds. Ashimbabar dispatched people to Abzu for the Maugre boat's pitch. Nanna-Suwen dispatched people to Duwashago for its rushes. Ashimbabar dispatched people to the cypress forests for its strakes. Nanna-Suwen dispatched people to the forest of Kug Nuna for its ribbing. Ashenbabbar dispatched people to the forests of Ebla for its planking. Nanaswen dispatched people to the fragrant cedar forest for its fir wood. Ashenbabbar dispatched people to the junipers of Lengi. And, well, you get the idea, I think. It seems likely that this divine poem is describing the construction of a reed boat with wooden ribbing along the boat's interior, which was a type of boat that was probably very common in ancient Sumer. Our second text today is a Mesopotamian royal hymn called Shulgi and Ninlil's Boat. Shulgi was the second king of the third dynasty of Ur. He ruled for about 40 years, and the middle of his reign fell right at about 2000 BC. To me, this text is a beautiful description of a boat that was used in religious ceremony, but it also gives us a glimpse at the way Sumerians viewed boats, the water, and their world. Listen to the way the boat is described as it's being prepared for the goddess Ninlil. I'm not going to try to sing it, but the hymn went something like this. O barge, Enki assigned the quay of abundance to you as your fate. Father Enlil looked at you with approval. Your lady, Ninlil, commanded your construction. She entrusted it to the faithful provider, King Shulgi. And the shepherd, who is of broad intelligence, and who will not rest day and night in thinking deeply about you. He, the wise one, who is proficient in planning, he, the omniscient one, who will fell large cedars in the huge forests for you. He will make you perfect, and you will be breathtaking to look upon. According to your large reed mats, you are a daylight, spread widely over the pure countryside. According to your timbers, you are a sniffing serpent, crouching on its paws. According to your punting poles, you are a dragon, sleeping a sweet sleep in its lair. According to your oars, you are a snake, whose belly is pressed against the waves. According to your floor planks, you are currents of flood, sparkling altogether in the pure Euphrates. According to your side planks, which are fastened into their fixed places with wooden rings, you are a staircase leading to a mountain spring. According to your panels, you are a persistent and firmly founded abundance. According to your bench, you are a lofty dais, erected in the midst of the abyss. According to your glittering golden sun disk, hoisted with leather straps, you are a brilliant moonlight, shining brightly upon all the lands. According to your long side beams, you are a warrior who is set straight against another warrior. It's really beautiful imagery, and again, this text gives us a practical insight into the parts that were used to build a Sumerian boat. However, it also gives us a sense of just how majestic these boats could be when they were outfitted with the gold and decor of the time. It's a little bit of a shame that we lose some of that beauty by only having relics and dusty remains to look at today. I hope that taking the time to look at those two religious texts was beneficial. But let's now get back into the flow of history. When we left off, Sumer's dynastic period had just about run its course, and we looked at some evidence of maritime exploits as taken from the royal graves at Ur. The next major figure in our history supposedly had his start in a baby-sized reed boat. But no, I'm not talking about Moses of biblical fame. Rather, I'm talking about Sargon of Akkad, a Semitic ruler who emerged to forge an empire and conquer Sumer somewhere around 2300 BC. If you'll allow me to drastically condense this empire builder's half-century reign into a very small, bite-sized chunk, it's sufficient to say that he led a conquest of the major Sumerian cities and created an empire that stretched from the Persian Gulf in the south to possibly the Mediterranean, but assuredly to the northwest of Akkad, all the way to the Taurus Mountains and the Semitic peoples who lived there. Sargon foisted a unified political entity upon the subjugated cities, and he entrusted the administration of his empire to Akkadian men. In fact, he made Akkadian the official language of his empire, which forced the southern Sumerian cities to relegate their native tongue to the background. The practical result of Sargon's empire is that he controlled the world's first large multi-ethnic empire. This allowed him to take advantage of the situation and order the riches of the empire brought to his capital city of Akkad, a capital city that, surprisingly, hasn't been discovered yet. We do at least have a general idea of the area where it's suspected to have stood, but the physical location is yet to be found. Sargon's connection to maritime history is quite significant, as we see in an inscription that survives to this day. Its words reveal to us the extent of his empire's influence, and show us just how far trade extended in the ancient world. The inscription reads like this: "Sargon, the king of Kish, triumphed in 34 battles over the cities up to the edge of the sea and destroyed their walls. He made the ships from Maluha, the ships from Magan, and the ships from Dilmun tie up alongside the quay of Akkad. Sargon the king prostrated himself before Dagan and made supplication to him. And Dagan gave him the upper land, namely Mari, Yarmuti, and Ibla, up to the cedar forest and up to the silver mountain. Sargon, the king to whom Enlil permitted no rival, 5,400 warriors ate bread daily before him. Whoever destroys this inscription, may An destroy his name, may Enlil exterminate his seed. I'm hoping that my name and my seed will live on since I did my part in propagating the inscription there. But anyways, maybe you noticed in that inscription the names of a few places whose ships Sargon made tie up at the quay of his capital city. Dilmun was mentioned, and as we saw last time, this is likely a reference to a culture that prospered as a Persian Gulf trade center in modern-day Kuwait. It also mentioned Magan, who we saw has come to be identified with a culture that was based at the mouth of the Persian Gulf, near the current-day country of Oman. Magan is described in Sumerian and Akkadian texts as a source of copper, stone, and boat-building timber, and it's likely that goods from Magan were processed in Dilmun as they made their way up to Mesopotamia. The final place that the inscription mentioned, Maluha, is the most mysterious, and it's for that reason that we assume it was also probably furthest away from Mesopotamia. Other than its description as a source of raw materials, very little detail is given about Maluha, but semi-precious stones and etched beads that seem to be from the Indus Valley region have also been unearthed in Mesopotamia. The general consensus at present is that Maluha was probably in the region of the Indus Valley civilization. It could possibly even have been the Akkadian name for the people that we now call the Indus Valley civilization. And we have found some indicators to that effect in Mesopotamian archaeological sites. We'll talk about the Indus Valley civilization in a future episode, and maybe we'll draw some more detailed connections there. Even after the founder of the Akkadian Empire passed off the scene, trade continued to remain strong, and wealth continued to flow into Mesopotamia. There's a beautiful murex shell that bears the name Remush, king of Kish, and this shell attests to the wealth that continued to flow in, even as Remush fought to keep his father Sargon's empire intact. Rimush was succeeded by his brother Manishtu, who actually extended Akkadian control to the east and into the Iranian plateau. Manishtu was in turn succeeded by his son, Naram Sin, the ruler who saw the Akkadian Empire at its apex. If there is doubt about whether Sargon's empire reached all the way to the Mediterranean, it's more likely that Naram Sin's empire did in fact reach that far, stretching from there all the way back to the shores of the Persian Gulf. It's also during this reign that we find what is quite possibly the first mention of a military fleet. Inscriptions naming Naram Sin claim that he assembled a fleet and sailed against a confederation of Magan cities. Although he failed to add Magan to his empire, he returned with much spoil, and we can see some evidence of this result in an inscription from a vase. This vase was lost during a French archaeological expedition in 1855, but one of the members of that expedition made a pressing of the inscription, so we at least know what the vase said, even if we don't know exactly what it looked like. This is what it said. Naram Sin, king of the four corners of the world, a vase, the spoil of Magan. What this tells us then is that he probably was, in all likelihood, there on a military expedition, and he probably got there on a ship. So this is pretty clear evidence, as I said, of at least a small military fleet and an invasion of a foreign land. So I mentioned that the Akkadian Empire was at its apex under Naram Sin, but not long after his death, most of Mesopotamia entered a period known as the Gutian Interlude. Mountain-dwelling people known as the Guti had existed on the outskirts of the Akkadian Empire for a couple of centuries. They were known for carrying out sporadic raids on the outer-lying Akkadian holdings and outposts. Shortly after Naram Sin's reign concluded, Akkadian dominance began to wane. This decline was perhaps a result of Akkadian overextension, combined with the reality that many of the city-states under Akkadian control had once been independent, and after a while they grew to resent foreign rule. So a combination of unrest in outlying cities and an increase in the frequency of Gutian raids in the northwest eventually led to the fall of the Akkadian Empire. And this fall was accompanied by a sharp decline in the amount of trade that was taking place in the Persian Gulf. This period of Akkadian decline was known as the Gutian Interlude because some of the Guti, who had previously just carried out sporadic raids, grew in power to the point where they controlled a large portion of the former Akkadian Empire. But as former raiders and bandits are known to do, the Gutian dynasty was marked by inefficient administration, poor leadership, and really overall declines in trade, agriculture, and general prosperity across the board. The Guti ruled for about a century from 2150 down to about 2050 BC, and some historians refer to the Gutian period as being a Sumerian Dark Age. Within that darkness, though, there was at least one light that continued to shine in southern Mesopotamia. That light was shown by the Ensi of Lagash, a ruler named Gudea, spelled with a D, even though his name sounds very similar to the people who had taken over Akkad before him. Gudea ruled in Lagash, and even though the Gutians could probably have toppled his city, along with many of the others that they did topple, they instead chose to let Lagash alone, since its leaders were more accepting of Gutian control within their region. Gudea gained a reputation for rebuilding many of the temples in Lagash, and he's well known to us today because there are many inscriptions and likenesses that bear his name and image. A famous statue with his name contains an inscription that details the temple he built or renovated in Lagash. The statue itself says that it is dedicated to, quote, Gudea, the man who built the temple. May his life be long. Gudea's temple building campaign bears a resemblance to that of Ur-Nanch, who we met last time, and it tells us that at least in Lagash, Persian Gulf trade was still alive and kicking. In fact, other inscriptions from this period show us that Gudea had trade with practically the entire civilized world. A particularly striking inscription is contained on a statue known as Statue B, but I think it's more appropriate to call this by its nickname, Architect with Plans. This statue shows Gudea seated, and it shows him holding the plans for the temple at Eninu on his knees, while the inscription that's around the rest of the statue, around its base, and is also one of the longest Sumerian inscriptions in existence, it tells of the offerings made at the temple, and it lists the numerous cities where Gudea obtained materials for the temple's construction. The beautiful inscription tells how he obtained gold from Anatolia and Egypt, silver from the Taurus Mountains, cedar from Amanus in Lebanon, copper from the Zagros Mountains, diorite from Egypt, carnelian from Ethiopia, and timber from Dilmun. It's also likely that Gudea's trade routes may have continued to reach south to Magan and Muluha, places that we mentioned a little bit earlier, but the inclusion of these two places is a little bit more debatable since these places had begun to decline in power by the end of the 3rd millennium BC, which is the time frame when Gudea ruled in Lagash. Several decades after Gudea's death, a ruler named Utuhengel of Uruk arose to drive out the Gutians and begin what is seen as a Sumerian Renaissance period. Utuhengel did not last long in power, but Ur-Nammu took his place, and he is remembered as an able ruler and a rebuilder of temples and infrastructure throughout Sumer. He became the first king of the Third Dynasty of Ur, which was really the first Sumerian rule since the rise of the Akkadian Empire and then the Akkadians' displacement by the Gutian invasion. During this Third Dynasty of Ur, things in Sumer began to resemble their pre-Akkadian situation. Irrigation canals were repaired and improved, which in turn promoted agricultural development. The economy again became more centralized in the city-states, particularly in Ur. And Sumerian ships made trips to Dilmun, where they traded for goods that originated in Magan and Muluha. Trade even traveled the opposite direction, north and west, up the Euphrates, and then overland to the Mediterranean. Basically, then, the scope and quality of trade was as good during Ur's Third Dynasty as it had been at any time previous in Sumerian history. The specific dynamics of trade, as it was carried out by merchants and those merchants' relationship with the state and with the temples, is, I think, a fascinating topic. It can contribute a lot to our examination of ancient Mesopotamia. If you want to tune in next time, we're going to take a closer look at Mesopotamian merchants, so I hope you'll tune in, and I think it will be enjoyable. Before that, though, we do need to wrap up our look at the chronology in Sumer. While the Third Dynasty of Ur experienced what would turn out to be a brief revival, Assyria was becoming more solidified to the north. Dilmun featured heavily as the transit point where trade occurred in the Persian Gulf, but the Sumerians didn't well control the northern regions, where Assyria had reestablished its independence after the Gutian interlude had finished. In addition to the Assyrian growth, Sumer also had to deal with problems caused by both the Amorites and the Elamites, two people that had been brought within the control of Sumer, but who both began to fight for their independence as the Third Dynasty of Ur began to weaken. Much of the Sumerian collapse was brought on by a drought that lasted for years and caused the agricultural base of their entire society to literally dry up. As Sumerian cities dwindled both in size and power, the conquered peoples, who had no problem maintaining their allegiance during times of plenty, began to question their subservience to Sumer. The drought wore on, and a Semitic-speaking people from Syria, called the Amorites, began a mass migration into Sumer that further exacerbated the effects of the drought. As the collapse gathered speed, the Elamites then launched an invasion against the last Sumerian king, Ibi-Sin. There are three letters, tablets, from the end of the Third Dynasty of Ur that give us a glimpse into the state of affairs as Ur met with its end. The first letter is most relevant to maritime history, and it tells how Ibi-Sin had sent one of his right-hand men, Ishbi-Era, on a grain-buying expedition. Ishbi-Era's report details how he had obtained 72,000 gur of grain, and having heard that the Amorites were marching into Sumer, he brought the grain not to the capital city of Ur, but to Isin instead. He then asked the king to send 600 boats of 120 gur each, so he could distribute the grain to the various cities of Sumer who needed food. I should mention, a gur is a unit of measurement for grain, and the carrying capacity of a 120 gur boat would be in the ballpark of 10 tons of grain. So 600 boats carrying 10 tons of grain each is a pretty substantial amount of grain. Even on its last legs here, we can see how Sumerian civilization still managed to carry out large-scale trade in the Persian Gulf. Be that as it may, the last two letters from the trio give us a good synopsis of why the Third Dynasty of Ur ultimately fell. In exchange for distributing grain to the Sumerian cities, Ishbi-Era managed to coerce the king into giving him control of Nippur and Isin, two other cities. He turned that gain to his advantage, and eventually he took the throne himself in that region, contributing to Ur's demise and establishing a smaller dynasty that ruled in Isin, even as the Amorites and Elamites fought for everything else. With the end of Ibi-Sin's reign, the Third Dynasty of Ur and the whole of Sumerian dominance was over, the year 2004 BC. For the next two centuries, ambitions in Mesopotamia seem to have been focused on maintaining order and control in the cities. The previous focus on expansion and trade had been shattered when the Amorites and Elamites burst on the scene, but things in Mesopotamia were a bit more complicated than is worth going into, considering that we're focused just on maritime history and not necessarily on everything else. The old Assyrian kingdom grew steadily to the north of where Sumer once lay, but Assyria was landlocked for the most part, so maritime exploits are almost non-existent in ancient Assyria. Instead, their focus was on overland trade with the Hittites and the Mitanni, who resided in Asia Minor to the west. The dark horse of this time period was most definitely Babylonia, an independent state that didn't emerge until 1894 BC. With the city of Babylon as its capital, Babylonia was a thorn in the side of Assyria, until an Amorite named Hammurabi took the throne in around 1790 BC. Hammurabi is well remembered as the man who united the disparate kingdoms of his time into the first Babylonian Empire of history. He pronounced his law code to the empire. In our next episode, we'll consider the impact of Hammurabi's law code upon the life and trade of Babylonian merchants. Just as quickly as he unified the empire, though, it began to fragment once again, and Hammurabi's death around 1750 BC marked the start of a decline in maritime trade throughout the Persian Gulf. The once powerful Indus Valley civilization had, for other reasons, also begun to decline by this point, cutting off a main source of goods that had long been imported into Mesopotamia. Hammurabi's death, then, began a trend that continued for at least 200 years. But in reality, Persian Gulf trade never again reached the level that it had once attained. When the Hittites overran Babylonia, the door slammed closed on maritime trade in the Persian Gulf, and this door would stay closed for almost 1,000 years. That's the bulk of what I had for today. I hope you'll join us next time as we look at the lives of merchants in ancient Mesopotamia up through the rise of Babylonia. The Code of Hammurabi contains a surprising number of provisions that are related to shipbuilding and the regulation of commerce, so that should be an interesting episode. I do also think it's important to mention as we end here that even though we virtually reached 500 BC in our look at Persian Gulf trade, there are several other civilizations and peoples that we're going to meet before we move into the classical period. As Mesopotamia flourished, so did Egypt. The Phoenicians held a practical monopoly on trade in the Mediterranean, and the Indus Valley civilization existed on a small scale that is often overlooked. There were also the Mycenaeans, the Minoans, and the mysterious Sea Peoples, all three whom we shouldn't forget about. So we've really just begun our look at maritime history in the ancient world, with much more to come. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll join me again next week at the same time. If you like what you've heard today, visit the program page on boatradio.net. There you can find a link to my main website, where I have supplementary maps, images, source lists, and other beneficial supplementary materials. The website also has info about how you can help support the continued production of this free and independent program. Plus, you can find links to connect with the program on social media for other news and interesting info about maritime archaeology and history. I hope you'll join me next week and every week thereafter as we progress through the stories of maritime history together. Until next time, fair winds and following seas. Thanks for listening to the Maritime History Program.